Trust isn't something you have to give to anyone. Trust is something you choose to give to anyone because it belongs to you to give in the first place, was an incredibly useful realization for me. Do you know how to find those trustworthy people out there? Here's the big secret. Be trustworthy yourself.
This is Humble Mind, a social learning community with an insatiable curiosity for conversations and connections that matter in life and in business. This podcast is where we get to speak with other humble minds. And if you're a member of our community, you get to join our recording live, like we have Troy and Rana here with us today. You also get access to early releases of new clips on our platform, our weekly newsletter, our exclusive chat group, content replays from previous sessions, as well as an invitation to join us on our Thursday Thrive live group meetup. So check out join.humblemind.co for more. Did you know that the world loses almost $2.6 trillion every year to corruption and mistrust? It's safe to say that trust is in freefall around the world. But why? How did we get here? What's been the breakdown in our fundamental inability to trust each other, trust our governments, our bosses, our parents, and possibly even ourselves? How can we evolve our understanding of trust that makes us better custodians and practitioners of the most fundamental force in human relationships? Well, today, Dominic Wilhelm from the Global Trust Project is with us to hopefully answer some of those, as well as leave us with a few other deep, important questions as well. The Global Trust Project is an international advisory that works to build trust-rich pathways at personal, professional, and societal levels. They're also a member of the VUCA group. Dominic's work has taken him to advise big bodies across the world, such as the UNEP, the XPRIZE, the JFK Library Foundation, and many other global organizations on this essential but often misunderstood topic. So it's a great pleasure to have you with us today on the podcast. Dom, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me. It's so nice listening to your dulcet tones. I'm all relaxed. I'm ready to roll. Thanks, Alex.
So with you being ready to roll, I'll kick it off with maybe just an understanding, or listening to your understanding, of what is trust? How can someone like me, who is a dad, a business owner, a human being, someone who's trying to make my way through life, think about trust in an intuitive way that makes sense? How could we define it for our conversation?
I love the way that you started it, because when we think of trust as something out there, it's not tangible. When we think of it as something external to us, trust certainly is something that, if we start the conversation internally, a lot of the questions we are looking to be answered, like why do we lose $2.6 trillion a year, or why do organizations fall apart, etc., the answer to those questions become self-explanatory and self-evident when we start with a fundamental understanding of trust. So here it goes. Let me start with a broadly validated definition of trust, and then perhaps try my best to give some examples. So trust is the willingness to be vulnerable based on expected behaviors. And that's pretty much it. So let me give you an example. So Troy and I, we've just met on this podcast. If Troy and I are to experience trust with each other, it will involve me with you, Troy. How could I do that? I could divulge personal information. On a personal level, it might have something to do with my mental health, a relational issue, a growth issue, something I might have messed up on. Professionally, it might mean, Troy, I've made an investment or strategic decision that has exposed me to potential corporate damage. And this is all information and stuff that Troy could run away with and harm me with. But because of the behaviors I expect from Troy through my experience and or reputation of Troy, I have chosen to expose myself to that type of harm. So it begs the question, what are the behaviors that I've seen in Troy which would lead me to trust him? And we'll discover in this conversation that there are some very basic principles that underpin the behaviors that would do exactly that. In other words, lead me to trust Troy. So in summary, trust is the willingness to be vulnerable based on expected behaviors of the other.
I love the word vulnerable in there, because I think that, you know, you obviously, in my intuitive thinking about trust, you obviously can't trust somebody if you don't know what they're like when they're vulnerable or whether they're being vulnerable. I think that we all have that inbuilt kind of, inner pendulum that kind of tells us whether there's something about this guy, or yeah, I think I can trust this person, right? And that gut, right? Is there something you can tell us about what that gut is, or where that comes from, how it operates, and why that often seems to really kind of tell us what we need to know when we're trying to work out whether somebody can be trusted?
Yeah. So we choose to be vulnerable when we observe or sense certain behaviors in someone else. So how do we do that? There, broadly speaking, are two ways. We can sense those behaviors through our enteric nervous system. And some talk about our enteric nervous system as the other brain. It is connected to our brain through the vagus nerve. And we can observe in each other certain facial expressions, posture, demeanors, turn of phrase, intonations, so on and so forth. And so we may not rationally know why we trust someone, but having sensed those things, our gut tells us, this person is trustworthy. When it comes to rationally understanding why someone is trustworthy, that's more about logic. It's about facts. It's about understandable visual cues. It's about the arithmetic of someone. It's about their credibility established over time through things that they have done, which have led me to believe that this person is trustworthy. And on that note, these mechanisms have been part of our brain and our physiology ever since we've been upright and either migrated south or north into or off the African continent. And they have been fundamental to us creating a sense of community, a sense of collaboration in very practical ways, and navigating ever more complex communities. This ability to know who is and who is not trustworthy.
It feels like trust is very much at the core of just everything. It feels like it just underpins everything. You mentioned collaboration, you mentioned community, communication, all of these things. I cannot imagine how they would work without trust. And I suppose that's the answer, right? They wouldn't be able to.
Yeah.
Does that also mean then that because it's so fundamental, it's almost intangible, it's almost something that can't be defined? Surely then, you know, with you being here and the Global Trust Project, you've found a way to crack that code. So I'm keen to hear how you make trust tangible.
Yeah. So trust can be simultaneously one of the most energizing and numbing conversations at the same time. The reason for that is we all know it's missing, whether or not we've looked at the data, so to speak, or we know it in our gut, or we just see it everywhere. But it can appear so ineffable and so unexplainable, inexplicable, that we numb at the idea of trying to quantify it and understand it. And little anecdote, I happen to ask people what trust is a lot. I've done it several hundred times. And there is always, in my experience, there is always a different explanation, a different hue, a different slant, a different emphasis, etc. But embedded in these different responses, there are three principles that emerge. And back to back to whether or not this is non-tangible, and back to those behaviors which I mentioned that I see in Troy or don't see in Troy that cause me to trust Troy. Let me just step back for a moment. There is trust, the psychological state, and that's my willingness to be vulnerable. That's the psychological state.
Mm.
But then there's trustworthiness. In other words, those things in the real world would activate that psychological state. Those things in the real world are those behaviors which I mentioned that I do or don't see in Troy. And there are only three principles which underpin those behaviors. In other words, if I see these three principles evident in these three behaviors, then it is very likely that I am going to trust Troy.
Mm.
And they are as follows. And by the way, these are what psychologists would call variform functional universals. In other words, these three principles, they are universally applicable, universally true. As long as there's a human in the room, these three principles are valid, and they are highly likely to foster trust. Okay. And I haven't cracked this code. These principles are evident in the literature. They are validated empirically. We can get into that in a moment. And they're also validated through a research of the trust literature. And by the way, the trust literature is deep and varied and has been emerging over the last 60 years or so. And it covers neurology, anthropology, sociology, psychology, so on and so forth. Okay. And here they are. Here are the three principles. If I see these three principles evident in Troy, it's highly likely we're going to trust each other. The first is integrity. Is Troy good? Mm. I want to know that. Is Troy good? And have I rationally come to this conclusion? And or affectionately come to this conclusion? In other words, do I emotionally sense it? You know, that enteric stuff I mentioned about. The second is benevolence. Is this conversation only about Troy, or is it reciprocal? Does Troy really have my interests at heart? And if it's a professional conversation and I happen to be in a leadership position working with 1,000 people, Troy also wants to know, have I really got the best interests of those 1,000 people at heart? Oh, and by the way, we're producing products that go around the world. Troy wants to know, where do those resources come from? And when that product gets into the hands of the people I've sold it to, have I sold it for a fair price? Or, is it going to fall apart the moment they get them? Okay, so that's benevolence. Troy also wants to know, and this is the third principle, am I capable? In other words, I'm selling him widget X. Have I ever made widget X before? Or I've committed to be Troy's friend. What are my skills with regards to being a friend? Do I know how to keep a secret? Am I reliable? Do I backbite? Do I gossip? Do I present myself to Troy in one way and to someone else in another way? In other words, am I double-faced, two-faced? So Troy implicitly or explicitly is looking for three simple principles to be evident in my life. And that is, am I good? Am I benevolent? Am I capable? Put another way, do I do the right thing? Am I considerate? And have I got the skills to get the job done? And by the way, trust and trustworthiness can be measured at any level and across all dimensions. And what I mean by that is trust is something that exists interpersonally, organizationally, and societally. It's so relevant to all three. And what I mean about cross dimensions is it's as applicable in the for-profit world as it is the non-profit world, no matter the sector, no matter the industry, no matter the product and service.
Hmm. That's a really useful way of thinking about what goes into kind of the principles of building a trust sort of based relationship, or I suppose making decisions based on whether trust is in the room or not. We, in the beginning, when I was introducing all of this, and this is taken from your site, which talks about, or some of the content that I've seen on the Global Trust Project, which talks about the fact that trust is in free fall around the world. So Clearly, somebody, or maybe a couple of people, need to start listening to these principles, because we clearly have an abundance of examples of where trust is not working in the right direction. There's a complete lack of it, right? And I don't want to have to waste time in pointing these examples out. We all can see things that are fraught in our relationships, in, you know, how we conceive of our politicians, of, you know, our relationship with our church, with our boss, with our teammates, with ourselves sometimes. We don't even trust ourselves. So clearly, there's a massive cavity here. Just for a moment, maybe you can tell me about how you see that freefall, and what's maybe just briefly contributed to that freefall, and how we can stop ourselves from falling, if ever that might be possible.
So how's this freefall evident? Why is it evident, and how do we address it? Are those the three questions?
Yeah, beautifully. Okay. In just a lot less time. So yeah, thank you for summarizing it.
So how do we know it's in free fall? Well, let's look to anecdote first. You ask anyone on the street, a friend, a colleague, you ask them, is the world missing trust at the moment? And anecdotally, we'll all roll our eyes and say, yes, absolutely. And there's all sorts of headlines we can bring to the fore and reason, so on and so forth. It's so much in free fall that the Secretary General of the United Nations a few years ago opened up the United Nations General Assembly by saying the world is suffering a bad case of trust deficit disorder. When it comes to the data, societal trust is in decline. So let's take United States, for example. It has declined more in recent years, I think in the last 5 to 10 years, more than it is declined since trust has been measured in the United States, which I think goes back about 30 or 40 years. So I think in the last 5 to 7 years, it's declined something like 20%. And similar statistics, in fact, far worse statistics in South Africa, for example, where I live. It has declined dramatically over the last decade. I think there's only just over 20% of citizens that trust government, for example. Organizationally, people are checking out globally when it comes to being engaged at work and trusting the work environment. People are just joining the dots at work. So engagement at work is down dramatically. Generalized trust around the world, in other words, that's the trust that the person on the street has for a number of different types of institutions and organizations, is way down globally as well. So most countries around the world are experiencing a decline in trust. So that's just a little bit about the data. And by the way, before I get on to why that's the case, this has very real measurable implications, a lack of trust. Here are three data points I use quite often. High trust countries, just along GDP lines, outperform low trust countries around 3,000%. And that data is from Our World in Data. High trust organizations outperform low trust organizations around 450%. High trust teams outperform low trust teams around 100%. So there are very, very tangible outcomes related to trust. The correlation is very, very convincing. And OECD, who has a wonderful department or an agency within it called the Trust Lab, has got some wonderful data showing the correlation between the presence of generalized trust and all of the well-being indicators, all of their 9 well-being indicators. Okay, so why are we struggling with trust, having observed it? I think fundamentally we struggle to relate to each other and to see each other. And let me just unpack what I mean by that. Some would argue that the brain is evolved to have meaningful relationships with around 150 people. And in those intimate relationships or more intimate relationships, we can more readily identify those three principles I mentioned earlier: integrity, benevolence, and capabilities. Let's just contrast that those 150 people to the world we live in today. We have varying degrees of relationship with hundreds to, if not thousands, of different people out there. We are exposed to the ideas, assumptions, presuppositions, ideologies, propositions, so on and so forth, of thousands and thousands of people, day in and day out, that want something from us or are asking us to contribute or engage in some way or another. We still have the same brain, yet we live in a distinctly different world. And I would imagine that in the world we find ourselves in now, it really is information overload, and it is difficult to distinguish those three principles: integrity, benevolence, and capability. And as a result, I think we have pulled up the drawbridge. And we have in some ways become rather insulated. Let me give you an example. I think of Amartya Sen's work, the Nobel Peace Prize winning economist. In his book, Identity and Violence.
Sounds like a good book.
He talks about how multiculturalism has actually played out. It's become a plural monoculturalism. In other words, when you put a lot of different people together, in some instances, our differences harden up and our edges harden up. And so we withdraw as we become overwhelmed with the other. I think also of Rabbi Sacks's work in Dignity and Difference. He talks about the same thing. When lots of difference finds itself in the same room, what differentiates us hardens up. So that coming together of many different points of view, that coming together of many different propositions and many different ideas, I think is in part to blame for the rise of that plural monoculturalism I mentioned, or that at least Amartya Sen mentions, also the rise in nationalism in Europe, certainly. And I think perhaps also the divides that we see, for example, in the United States. And those divides aren't unique to the United States, by the way. That is, the divide that everyone knows about between red and blue and so on and so forth. It's certainly not uniquely an American phenomenon. So why are we struggling with trust? Well, I think we are in many respects turning our backs on each other. And as a result, we cannot see integrity, benevolence, and capabilities in each other. And I think that's perhaps one of the greatest challenges that we have, creative challenges and human challenges, is the ability to transcend the boundaries which have us so divided and to give trust a chance. Related to that, over and above those three principles I mentioned, there's also something else that we would do well to take into consideration, as that is our inclination to trust each other. So back to Troy. And by the way, Troy, I'm sorry that I've picked on you, but you are the class guinea pig.
You're lucky he's a super trustworthy guy. So
Yeah. let's say Troy is entirely trustworthy. 10 out of 10. He has integrity, he has benevolence, he has capabilities. What happens if Dominic has an issue with black guys? Okay. What happens if I have an issue with the color of your skin? What happens if I have an issue about the shape of your sunglasses, making it a little bit more playful, or the fact that you are from, where are you from, Troy?
New Jersey.
New Jersey.
There you go. Yeah.
The crushed can of New York State, man.
There you go.
Whatever. Yeah. It's like, not New Jersey. I had a colleague once from New Jersey, and they did nothing except leave a whole bunch of blunt blades in my back, right? And therefore, my inclination to trust this guy is not my color and is from New Jersey of all places, is impacted by my personal experiences in the past. So my inclination to trust him is very, very low, irrespective of how trustworthy he is. So becoming self-aware of our biases and how to get past them, and also for Troy to overcome my issues and help me in compassion overcome my issues as well, is something that Troy could bring to, irrespective of the fact that I might be a dick, right? He brings compassion to it and he brings understanding to it and helps me through patience and long suffering in this relationship to help me come to terms with my biases, is also a very valuable thing to do. An anecdote that I heard, well, a story which I heard recently, if I could just share quickly, Alex.
Sure.
I've heard from various people, very interestingly, about the Hopi people over the past 2 years or so, one of the tribes in North America, one of the native peoples of North America. And as I understand it, the Hopi people have got a story which is central to their culture, and it involves the coming together of four peoples or four nations that originated in the same place. Okay. And apparently three of those peoples have come back and have been unified in the Hopi tradition, except for one. And there, I think one of the early people groups that came to the US, I forget where they're from, I think they came up via South America to the US, on coming upon the Hopi people, the following happened. One of the elders, if not the leader of the Hopi people, extended their hands like this to this. And I see you nodding your head, Troy. Maybe you can help me with the story. They extended their hands like this. And these, let me call them foreigners, okay, outsiders who had arrived in North America, thought that the Hopi people were asking for trinkets or something of value, or were asking for something. It was like begging almost. So they started giving them trinkets, etc. But what actually that person was saying was they were extending a hand of friendship. And even though they were given trinkets, that Hopi tribes person said to their fellow people that let's give them time to remember who they are and that they have returned. Right now, they don't know who they are. And let's give them time to remember who they are, that we're all from the same family. We are all of the same people. Let us give them time to remember that. And by the way, that checks out scientifically. We are all from someone called, by the way, mitochondrial Eve. In other words, everyone on this call, as is everyone, every Homo sapien on the face of the planet, is literally related to the same matriarchal ancestor. We are all literally related. We are all literally brothers and sisters, which marries up wonderfully with that Hopi story. Why do I bring this up? The inclination of that person who was the newcomer to North America, their inclination to trust this trustworthy person, meant that they couldn't build a relationship, and led to all sorts of atrocities in North America, as we all know.
So you've said so many kind of important things there that really I'd love to unpack all of them. I don't know if we'll have time to do that, but maybe just lingering for a moment on the idea of inclination, because I've not heard you kind of describe it like that before, and I've not heard it described at all like that before, which is really interesting and quite thoughtful. It sounds like inclination, it seems to be the most important factor, or it's almost like the kill switch on whether those other three principles can show up when there's, you know, there's trust, or there's trust to be built or earned between individuals. Because if I don't, you can have all of the integrity, the benevolence, the capability, but if I'm not inclined to trust with you, if I have a fundamental bias within myself to not want to talk to guys from New Jersey or people from South Africa or wherever that might be, or just my own personal biases, then it's never going to work. So the inclination is really interesting, because it 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 for me at least it reflects this idea that trust has to be a choice. Because if I maybe I'm just making this up now, but if I have to choose to want to trust you, right? Like if I am going to be trusting somebody or taking the first step in creating a, you know, a trust-based relationship with someone, it starts with someone just deciding, okay, I'm going to go with this. Surely at some fundamental level. Would you agree with that? Is that something that makes sense?
A lot comes to mind. Okay, firstly, to the point of inclination. Inclination, what I'm referring to is one's inclination to trust someone else. And that inclination is preset in so many different ways, you know, through our life experience. And I gave some silly examples earlier, how this racist, white, bald South African doesn't trust a dude from New Jersey, right? So there's a number of ways. From New Jersey. So, and those in my inclination can be for reasons known and unknown to me. And sometimes the worst person to know yourself is yourself.
Right.
So that can be a journey. And there's wonderful practical tools out there to reflect. You know, I think, for example, of Johari's window, for example, is a wonderful way for groups to reflect on you know, self-identity, so on and so forth.
What is that? Just briefly, just so you know, what do you mean?
The Johari window. Johari, it's a, to my ear, peculiar name, but it's just the conflation of two surnames of the psychologist that came up with this this very useful tool to help reflect, to help self-reflect.
Okay.
Yeah. Either personally or at group level. Now, to trust being a choice or not, a little game theory experiment comes to mind. And it shows that those who choose to be trustworthy first foster, on average, trusting relationships out of the gates. So it's tit for tat. So back to Troy, let's say we sit down and Troy actually decides to, without knowing me, decides to lend me $10, or without knowing me, chooses to forgive me, or without knowing me, it makes himself vulnerable to me in a way in which he can survive. If he does that consistently, the research tells us that I will be much more likely to reciprocate based on his choice to trust me in the first place. So that's a very interesting peculiarity
that makes sense
about
to me.
The human condition. Yeah. Yeah. Also, to your point about trust, sometimes it's not an explicit choice, but back to the gut feel, it's something that we feel before we know.
Right.
Having picked up on a million different cues that we can't rationally verbalize but are internally true to, you know, to that affectionate point about, you know, trusting the other. And again, on the point of choice, let's say I'm consistently an idiot towards Troy, but he is determined to build trust for whatever reason, out of compassion, out of a strategic need, out of the fact that I'm his brother-in-law married to his sister, and he just flip, you know, there's another 50 years of this to go. Let's try and make this work kind of thing, whatever it might be. If Troy chooses to be consistently trustworthy based on those principles I mentioned earlier, we are going to have a much higher chance, despite my inclination, to build a trusting relationship.
It's interesting you say that, and I'm seeing some heads nod, because it feels like that the way you've explained it, you know, I don't need to think about it before I know that what you're saying is kind of true. It's almost like a kind of a self-trusting of what my gut is hearing, and kind of thinking, yeah, that makes sense. I would trust your answer on that, and perhaps that helps to reinforce what we're saying. Go for it.
It's also a choice. We can also make a choice to validate someone's trustworthiness. So Troy even though I'm being an idiot towards him, may choose as well to look into me, to look into my past, to ask some colleagues, to ask some friends, to ask some family, with that lens of trustworthiness, integrity, benevolence, capabilities, looking for those indicators, those antecedents in me, and upon that to build a picture of what my trustworthiness actually is, despite my inclination to trust him. So it is a choice to look into the facts of the matter as well, despite first impressions, which takes effort. Hence, we have heuristics, right? Taking masses of information and reducing them to simple stop-go indicators. Heuristics can be our enemy. Reducing complex decisions to simple stop-go indicators. And to put those heuristics aside, those decision-making mechanisms that can be very useful, but putting them aside to look deep into the fact of the matter, we may actually find a trustworthy person and their lower inclination to trust us.
Yes, yes, exactly. Yeah, it's a fundamentally different system at play, a different clock at work, right? Yeah, absolutely. I just want to shift quickly to the concept of influence. And I know this is something you talk about sometimes. I read what you said, you know, the idea of influence without trust is manipulation. And I think that on a broad level makes sense, right? If I'm trying to influence your decision on something, but you don't trust me or have reason to trust my position or who I am or maybe my track record, then I'm just flat out trying to manipulate or bullshit you. So that makes sense. Can you maybe talk a little bit about how you see influence, and perhaps attached to that, can there be such a thing as sustainable influence, maybe in the way that we look at trust at a governmental level or as a social level, you know, between communities, not just individuals, which is what we've been talking about now, but at a higher level between groups of people? Is there a way to think about a different alternative model of positive influence, of trust-based influence, that doesn't screw everybody in the current way that we're doing it right now? Is there a way to be sustainable in that influence making and sharing?
Yeah. Okay. So to the first question about influence, we all seek to influence someone at some stage in our life, and influence is everywhere. You've influenced people to be on this call. Others have influenced us to make purchasing decisions or relational decisions, or we're always wanting to exercise influence. We don't control people, right? Well, sometimes it is a command and control relationship, and sometimes for very good reason. But this act of influence is fundamental to the human condition, lest we go live on an island somewhere. Okay. But if we take the word influence, like we take the word trust seriously, and we look at what it means to change the way someone thinks or acts. Like, you know, how dare we on a certain level, you know, get inside someone's head or heart and cause them to change based on what we say or do. And by the way, that's why narrative and story is so incredibly powerful, and to my mind should be stewarded with respect, because if one can tell a story properly, and it just so happens the archetypal story structure is the most influential, if we can tell a story properly, the way it dances with cortisol, oxytocin, and dopamine, it interacts with a part of the brain which inevitably shapes our behaviors. And that's why we want to, that's why we leave the darkened cinema wanting to wear Superman underpants, right? Well, at least I did anyway. We were just in a darkened cinema watching someone dance around in latex, throwing, you know, galaxies off their axes. Why would I want to be Superman when I leave the cinema? It's because of narrative immersion, and our brain can't tell the difference. So I want to be Superman. Okay. Back to influence. Influence is something we do all the time. Influence, in the absence of trust, is manipulation, most likely, for the following reasons. Why would I want to influence anyone to be on this call in the absence of integrity. Begs the question, well, then why do I want you on the call? Also, in the absence of benevolence, why would I want you on the call? And in the absence of capabilities, in other words, to deliver something of value to you, why would I want you to be on the call? There would be other motive. Who knows what it is? But it wouldn't involve integrity, benevolence, capabilities. Hence,
so fundamental dishonesty. Yeah.
Fundamental dishonesty. Exactly. So to do this sustainably, well, if you are trustworthy in the way in which we've been exploring it on this call, then sustainability is inevitable because it becomes part of your identity. And this is what attracts me to trust. I mean, forgive all of the waffle, okay, over the last 25 minutes. The waffle which is involved perhaps academic language and the waffle that is involved strategic language and organizational language, etc. And forgive me because there's a level in which I struggle to talk about this stuff. And what I mean by that is there's a gap between the deeply personal and the fundamentally human and the language we use to describe it. Okay. What has drawn me to trust is I cannot escape that it's fundamentally part of the human condition. And what I mean by that is we are fundamentally relational creatures, and without trust, we cannot be in relationship with each other. That's the joy, that's the challenge, that's the value there, all wrapped up in one. We're fundamentally relational, and without trust, we cannot be in relationship. And no wonder there's such a powerful correlation between the presence of this fundamentally human thing and extraordinary outcomes in all dimensions I mentioned earlier and across all domains. So when we are, okay, and when we are invited into being trustworthy, we're being invited into explore what is good. The philosophers would tell us that's all about axiology. We're invited into benevolence, okay, which is about reciprocity. And the sociologists and anthropologists would at that point talk about social cohesion. The sustainability people would talk about the SDGs and so on and so forth. And when we're invited into the conversation of capabilities, the theologians and also the philosophers would say, oh, that's all about praxis. My point is this, if we take the conversation of trustworthiness seriously, it cannot but be transformative because we are talking about our very nature. So to connect this to your question, how do we make it sustainable? Well, we will be living out of our true selves. So it cannot but be sustainable. Yes.
It has to be sustainable by its nature if we realize it in that way. And it's interesting, you talked a little earlier about storytelling in The Influence. I love storytelling. I talk about it often, and it makes sense once again what you said, because we do relate to each other, and we also relay information to each other in the medium of stories. You know, we've been doing that ever since our larynx could make grunts, right? So I think we're very good at storytelling in that way. We're very highly evolved and adapted to do that. And it makes sense that that's a vehicle for being able to pass on and to foster trust between people. I'm interested. I saw a clip that, or at least a post on social media of you a couple of weeks ago speaking to a group of fourth graders on the concept of trust. What did you learn from that experience? Because we're obviously talking at quite a high level now, and you know, you've got to kind of keep up in the situation in this conversation to really get all of the nuggets that you're throwing out here, and there are plenty of them. But when we're speaking to 9, 10-year-olds, what shifts, and what do you leave out? What do you keep in? What was that experience like for you?
Well, the experience was extraordinary, and I'll explain why. The more and more over the last several years that I've had the opportunity to share some of the insights of trust with others. And that involves to a large extent merely being a conduit for research that exists already. Okay. So I don't presume that there are these extraordinary insights that I've, you know, cracked some sort of psychological DNA or code. But as I've had the opportunity to do that, to share more and more and more, it's become more and more painful for me. And the reason for that is I'm so given and naturally drawn to the world of ideas. And that is a great joy of mine, the world of ideas. But we don't live in the world of ideas. We live in the world of actions, behaviors, measurables, and stuff that we can exchange between us. So the painful part has been this: making the theoretical practical.
Mm.
It's been an incredibly painful rational click I've needed to make. So a dear friend and mentor of mine said, you know what you need to do? You need to pull your finger out of your nose and go and speak to 10-year-olds. And I did that because if I can make it real to a 10-year-old, I'm making progress. And so the story, can I share the story with you?
Please, yeah.
The story went like this, and I'll do this as rapidly as I can. I shared with them that I spent 4 years, 4.5 years on a dream, and I was about to give it up. And they said, why? And I said, well, as an adult, it's quite important to have money in your bank account to pay for school fees and food and holidays, you know, that type of thing. And then, oh, okay. And I said, I was about to give it up until I made some new friends. And these new friends said to me, hey, don't give it up. We believe in what you're doing. And they helped me. And they gave me some money. And in the business world, we call that investment. And they gave me some new colleagues, people I can work with. And so on I went. And the reason they did that is because they believed they could trust me. And I too believed I could trust them.
Hmm.
And they said, so what does that mean? And I said, well, it's because they could see a treasure chest in me and I could see a treasure chest in them. And in that treasure chest, there are three jewels. And because they found those jewels, it's because of those three jewels that they could trust me and I could trust them as well. What are the jewels? What are the jewels? And I said, jewel number one is they thought that I was good. Jewel number two, they thought that I was considerate. And jewel number three, they thought I had the skills to bring that dream alive. And they also wanted to see that dream come alive as well. And I too could see that in them. Therefore, they believed I was trustworthy. And they were like, oh, fantastic. Okay. And of course, those three jewels are the three principles of trustworthiness.
Yes.
And then I said, okay, guys and girls, let's break up into groups and let's see how we can use these three jewels to figure out whether people online are trustworthy, our friends are trustworthy, our teachers are trustworthy, strangers are trustworthy, they are trustworthy. So they did that, came back and shared their findings. And in breaking it down into those three principles and sharing it as a treasure chest and using that kind of language, and also the fact that trust isn't something you have to give to anyone. Mm. Trust is something you choose to give to anyone because it belongs to you to give in the first place, was an incredibly useful realization for me. And this was the end of the story. I said, do you know how to find those trustworthy people out there, just like I found my new friends, as if they came out of nowhere? No, we don't. We don't. I said, here's the big secret. Be trustworthy yourself. Which I think resonates deeply in the real world.
Amazing.
It's not so much about, oh, how can I evaluate your trustworthiness? Of course, that's important. But if we ask ourselves first, how can we be trustworthy? There is something about the nature of the reality that we all share. And maybe you guys on the call can talk to this. There's something about the nature of reality that we all share that in manifesting something or being something we want to see in the world, it draws it towards ourselves.
Yes.
That sounds very Gandhi-esque, doesn't it?
It is.
Be the change in the world. That just dawned on me. But there's something fundamentally true in that. And if I may just share this, story. There are very few things in life that I can talk about with conviction and with certainty. There really are. There are a handful of things. But one of the things I can talk about with deep conviction is the relationship between a sense of self, and let's say a sense of trustworthiness, and opportunity rising to meet me. And what I mean by that is, as I've become more certain about these fundamental principles and my sense of who Dominic is in this world, and the thing that I feel I'm credible enough to share about, and in this instance, it is trust. As that has become more certain in my life, so opportunity has risen to meet me in the most extraordinary, unplanned ways. How is it now that I sit in a call with a gentleman from New Jersey, from Greece / Miami, from Spain, and Glenn, where are you from?
He's also in Spain.
You're also in Spain. Español. And how is it? This is beyond rational strategizing, right? But here we are. Mm. So one of the certain things I can certainly talk about in life is the correlation, the relationship between sense of self and the road rising to meet me. It's an incredible thing. And it speaks to that attracting of opportunity,
yes,
and people and things to you, based on being that those things in the first place in life.
Yes.
Thereth endeth the sermon.
No, beautiful. The way you've explained it, and also just the whole story, your experience of the treasure box and lighting up the imaginations of kids is awesome. I think adults need to hear that story exactly the way that you told it. You mustn't change a thing. Adults are often the biggest kids themselves anyway. So it makes sense on so many levels, and it's a great way to describe that. I love what you said about the general idea of starting with yourself as well. It is Gandhi-esque. It's a great message. Be the change, right? In order to want to see more trustworthiness in other people, you have to start being a beacon of that for yourself, or for other people, with yourself. And that is an incredibly powerful message, rather than always looking for the temptations of external things to help us, right? It's like, it's the kind of message that we always come back to. You know, it starts with, you know, anything meaningful will always start from within. And that's deep and it's real. I want to open up to Troy and to Rana and to Glenn. If there's some questions or comments, I've got something in the end where I want to just wrap up with some of the practical tools, one or two ideas that we can look at when it comes to building trust, aside from the one you've just given us, which is to trust yourself. But Glenn, did you want to say something?
Thanks for allowing me in partway through. And hopefully my comments, they won't, you might want to, I don't know whether you've covered these points, but what strikes me, Dominic, is that certainly there's a lot of correlation with the descriptions that you gave since I came in. And certainly in my example, or in my 59 years of living, I've always sensed that people want to deeply trust, but often they feel unsafe. And feeling unsafe has become a bit of a car crash through pandemic levels of trauma for us humans, and passed on trauma and ancestrally. The root, as I totally agree, is about this disconnection to self. So the division, the most powerful aspect of the root is the division away from self. And we might even take that further than psychology and say source, something greater than ourselves, which really has the ability or the power and the depth, almost like a fountain of trust that can hold all of our struggles and challenges. So that division creates, and getting back to that, getting back past through that division through practical, simple exercises, then, which there are plenty, breath for me being one of those, then I begin to come back to this whole sense of self, which is much greater than what I am. And even though I might have to go gulp, I've got the ability, because I've got enough of a safety platform to go and make that first step. And so I hope that's supportive of your message throughout the time you've been together.
Certainly, it certainly speaks to me about inclination. If I
I
think
think,
of inclination, I'm sorry, go ahead.
no, sorry, you just nudged me to. I think for me also, it's very much an embodied quality as well. So it's the embodiment of those qualities in the face of challenge and fear and change and turmoil that almost becomes our anchor to be able to then bring it out to the world. Because of course, if something isn't embodied, as you were indicated in the great storytelling challenge with the children, how can I change what I'm offering so people can embody that and it won't kind of slip by them at an intellectual level?
Yeah, couldn't agree with you more. Yeah. I think you mentioned Alex, you mentioned self-trust and the challenge to self-trust. And I think of what you just said now, Glenn, about embodiment. I think in speaking to the children, I overcame in that process, somehow, some of the last vestiges of lack of self-trust and self-worthiness. Because there was a part of me that perhaps surfaced subconsciously that I'm speaking to little people, and I'm a parent myself. And it really, I think, challenged me as to whether I really believe these things that I'm sharing with these little people, with these little heads and hearts. And in doing that, in crossing that bridge, I think it's helped me to embody these truths, which I believe are true. There've been several people over the last short while that have said something has changed in you. Something has changed in your turn of phrase, and something has changed in your approach, and so on and so forth. To share personally, it's that change has driven my wife to tears, as an example, because there's a part of me that she hasn't seen in the last 22 years of marriage. The reason I'm specifically bringing this up now is to amplify your point about embodiment. And that is when we fully embody our true nature and our true convictions, there's something extraordinarily powerful about that. That's why I brought that up. Yeah.
Absolutely. And well, that's you. That's the sensation of you being the change. So, yeah, I hope you've acknowledged yourself for that. That's awesome. Rana, did you want to say something?
Yes. First of all, Dominic, thank you. Wonderful to just all of the concepts and what you have re-emphasized for where I am today. One of the things that kind of comes screaming to the surface for me is this global sense of disparity and deficiency, and this sense of hoarding, and this, for me, the inclination stems from my seeing value in being vulnerable to seed these relationships, to foster an environment of trust. And it's, as we stepped into, as I was invited into this HumbleMind community, and as I very joyfully stepped into this space, it's, stepping into this place of being an entrepreneur, whatever that might look like. But it's owning my dream, and it's seeing value in my dream, even in the face of, wow, can I actually do this? And as you said, Dominic, as you were just sharing, it's like it's people seeing shift, a very profound shift in you when you embody that trust within your own vision. And I think it's not even really a question. It's more just an acknowledgement is we have this great value in recognizing what our contribution of living our vision is to this world, what the ripple effect is, and how that ripple effect affects others. It's almost like how can we step into this place of finding value in just as somebody coming from the U.S. of finding value of creating relationship and trusting a nationalist Trump supporter. It's about seeing people that press our buttons and trigger these, as Glenn was talking, these intergenerational, these archetypal spaces. They trigger. And how can we almost go beyond those triggers and see the value to instill this inclination to build trust and to be vulnerable and to let our voice be heard, even though our past experience say it's been harmful, be it psychological or emotional. But I'm going to do it anyway, because if I don't do it, it's not going to happen, as you shared earlier. So,
yeah, it's a choice. Yeah, so well said. Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for sharing, Rana. Yeah, Troy, how about for you?
Yeah, I agree that it's choice and decisions. I think that, you know, being in the United States and being a part of the volatility that's happening here in this country, the divided sort of behavior. I think there's a bit of people allowing themselves to be manipulated because the truth is in front of us, but we don't want to acknowledge it. I think that when you have someone, Trump as an example, who has repeatedly shown over the course of his life that he's not trustworthy, and you choose to elect someone in a position of the highest power, speaks volumes to how we've sort of spiraled out of control in a way of not understanding the difference between trust and a lack of or untrustworthy. It's disheartening, but what I can do, the part that I can do, is continue to vote, continue to be the stability, whether it be in my family or in the organization that I support or in society, in my community. It's a decision that I make every day to be the example, regardless of my experiences and the things that how people have, you know, disappointed me for a lack of trust or lack of whatever the situations may have been, violations and all of that, and the backstabbing that Dominic spoke about. But I think larger than that, for me, it's the bigger picture, and to get sort of to the mountaintop kind of feeling and scenario for myself and for my family. It's a sad time, I think, in this country. And with each passing day, to not hold someone who breaks the law over and over again to not be held accountable is a slap in the face for those of us who are trustworthy and those of us who believe in, the law of the land, if you will, right? Yeah. The law says, don't steal, don't lie, don't rape. And to not be held accountable for those things is sort of, how do you reward someone for that? And what decisions are you making as an individual to allow someone to hold a high office when they've clearly, they don't respect trust. They don't respect law. They don't respect people.
I'd be interested to, it's a good point, Troy. And I suppose without getting kind of, drawn into the politics of it, it's interesting to sort of zoom out and see the fact that we might have these kinds of extreme political figures who everyone loves to hate, but at the same time they are products of the society that we all are part of and that we all are.
It's bigger than him. It's bigger
Yeah,
than
it is absolutely, and bigger than
he's just
just
the face. He's just the face.
individuals. Yeah,
Yes.
exactly. And
He's only the
and
face.
exactly. And the excesses we see are symptoms of the some sort of fundamental break in the trust and the trust creation process. I suppose also, and I'm interested to hear what Dom thinks as well, is that there's maybe a distinction worth making between trust and decision making, because we can start by trusting ourselves and thinking deeply about what trust means and think about trustworthiness and who is trustworthy. And then there's the decisions we make because, we're thinking about risk. We don't want to lose money. We're wanting to protect our families. And so sometimes we might be making those decisions without considering who we trust or considering the trust question at the heart of it. I'm not sure. Dom, do you have any thoughts on this? It's a really interesting topic.
Yeah, I think I would go back to those three core principles, when it comes to choosing which direction to go in. You know what? I'm actually reminded of the Cheshire Cat from Alice in Wonderland. And actually the fellow who wrote Alice in Wonderland was a logician.
Really? It was
Interesting fellow,
Carol,
yeah.
right?
I forget it. Yes, there you
It was Carol, yeah.
go. And I forget, was that the real name or was that the pseudonym? I think
Oh,
that was the
maybe.
pseudonym. Yeah, that's the pseudonym. Anyway, so Alice, as we all remember, ends up at a crossroads for all intents and purposes. She sees the Cheshire Cat. She says, "Cheshire Cat," this is going to be a terrible paraphrase, but I've got the gist of it. "Cheshire Cat, which way should I go? I don't know which way to go." And the Cheshire Cat says, "Well, it depends, my darling. Where would you like to go?" And she says, "Well, I don't care very much of where I'd like to go." And then he says, well, then it doesn't matter very much about which path you take. So a decision-making process is a function of who we want to be, where we want to go, and the future that we want to see. So that becomes a very powerful self-organizing principle. Okay. The future we want helps us to decide which choices to make, firstly. Secondly, when it comes to the principles of trust, forgive me, this is perhaps an oversimplification, but it's a very useful lens. And it's been repeated a number of times in this conversation. I know, but it is in making a decision, which one has integrity, which choice has integrity, which choice is reciprocal, and which choice embodies the type of capabilities that are required in order for that choice to be a good decision. And that goes as much for what is being chosen as it goes for the person who's doing the choosing. Why am I choosing this? Out of what motive? Am I qualified to make the choice? So on and so forth. It reminds me of our deep problems rooted in democracy, embedded in democracy. And there's a reason why Plato's thought that democracy was a waste of time. It's a little clip I actually shared recently. I think it was of one of America's comedians, who I don't know much about, Jordan Klepper, I think is his name. And he says, democracy involves, well, he said, did you know that 1 in 10 people think that chocolate milk comes from brown cows, which is apparently a valid statistic? And he said, when I think about the fact that it's those people we're calling on to weigh up on foreign affairs, it makes me pretty skeptical about democracy. So, embedded in democracy, there's all sorts of opinions. Anyway, just reminded of that story as an aside. But yeah, back to the decision-making process. It's about our trustworthiness as much as it is as about the thing which we're trying to choose as well.
Okay, so maybe just last question before I let you go, just because, just like in your experience with those fourth graders, you were challenged to make the immaterial as tangible as possible, which you've definitely done a bit of today with us, so thank you. But is there any part of what you do also with the Global Trust Project is to kind of give teams and individuals and organizations tools to help to, get them on the right track when it comes to building trust, to earning it, to fixing it, or perhaps improving it. What are some of those tools, or perhaps maybe you just want to talk about one of them that someone can keep in mind, that perhaps someone listening to this podcast today, tomorrow morning, they can walk into their business and they can start thinking about things in a different way. They can start to be building or measuring trust in a much more useful way. Is there something that, if you were speaking to directly to that person, that you'd want them to keep in mind?
Can I venture to leave you with something that might resemble a mantra?
Oh, even better.
It's part of a little something I wrote the other day. Every day we open our streams, right? This isn't the mantra. This is the dramatic buildup to the mantra, okay? When we open our streams, you know, every day we're bombarded with 1,000 tips, right? And 1,000 frameworks and 1,000 bits of advice. Do this, do that. Leadership is this, strategy is that. Teamwork is this, performance is that, or all sorts of things. And it's overwhelming. And for reasons we touched on earlier in the conversation, we tend to shut down, right? Man, what do I do? Everything is valuable, therefore nothing is valuable. Everything is memorable, therefore nothing is memorable. Okay, we shut down, we tune out. So it is these three principles, and you know exactly where they come from. They are these three principles that I always remind myself of, this little mantra in any given situation. And that is simply this: do what is good, do what is considerate, and do it brilliantly.
And that's something that if someone can do or practice or sort of keep as a personal discipline for themselves, that is something that enables them to start with that trust from within, to see the trust they want to see in the world, to paraphrase Mr. Gandhi again.
Exactly that. You are implicitly orientating yourself towards trustworthiness. So I would maybe to embellish it a bit, it is do what is good, do what is considerate, and do it excellently, for in that you are becoming trustworthy, and trust changes everything.
Beautiful. Wow. Dom, I think I speak for everyone, not only the community, but also everyone listening, that I think this has been a unforgettable and very, very useful education, or re-education rather, in the concept of trust, helping us to demystify what it means for ourselves, how to think about it clearly and rationally, and how it affects other people. Because it just like trust itself, it can't, humans can't exist in a vacuum, and we depend on relationships, and we depend on functional relationships. So thank you for helping us to think about this fundamental concept in a really healthy way.
You use the word re-education. It reminds me of a word, remember. Everything that we've discussed on this call is utterly unoriginal. And the reason I'm saying that is trust is new. It's physiologically embedded in us. We've literally got mechanics that are evolved to determine, to sense what is trustworthy in this world. But to a large extent, we've forgotten it. So a lot has to do with simply remembering what trustworthiness is in the first place.
No, I agree. And absolutely. And you're endlessly modest, but at the same time, I'm acknowledging you as the storyteller and the harbinger of beautiful ideas, because everything else might be eternal and timeless and unoriginal, but you are original. So thank you.
Thanks
for sharing with us.
Thank you so much. And I love New Jersey, by the way.
Thank you. Thank you, brother.
Well, that all rings hollow now. Sorry, Dom. I believe you. I don't trust you.
Thank you so much. This is amazing. Thank you so much for sharing.
Lovely to meet you, Troy. And thank you, Alex, so much.
You also. Thank you.
Cheers. Thank you. Thanks for listening to this episode of Humble Mind. I hope you enjoyed it. If you're curious to take a look at our community, if you're not a member, you're missing out. Make sure you head to humblemind.co to check out more and to see what we're up to. I look forward to seeing you there. Until next time.